Pozcast. Thank you for having me, Joe.
Hi, welcome to the Pozcast. I am Joe Poznanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Joe, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You sound, I don't know, you know what the word I'm thinking of is? The word festive. You sound festive.
It's holiday time.
It is holiday time. How was your Thanksgiving? Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
It was very nice. We were here in LA and we had some family over and we had a lovely dinner and kids ran around and played and stuff. And then we took a little family trip to Ojai, which is a little like a nice, quiet sort of like a resorty place.
Nice.
A little north of here, and it's very, very calm and peaceful. And I don't play golf at all. I've never played golf really.
Okay.
I've said on Twitter that I'm going to run for president, and my platform will be
no golf.
Basically, and I won't be a jerk. although I don't use the word jerk on Twitter, and I won't be a jerk, and I'll never play golf because I really have no interest in playing golf. I have no interest in spending 4 hours playing golf. I find the game to be. I like to watch it sometimes.
Sure.
But I find the game to be maddening the few times I've played it. And also it takes 4 hours and it's absurd. But when we go to this hotel in Ojai, they have a driving range. And my son, who also can't play golf, and I like to go to this like driving. It's very beautiful. And we don't know what we're doing, but we just put balls on tees and we just try to hit them as far as we can. And it's delightful.
That's delightful. That is delightful.
Really fun.
And that's not golf at all, by the way.
No, that's a different thing.
It's a whole
different thing. That's me and my 9-year-old son finding it funny when we sometimes just swing and miss entirely. I'll tell you this: I probably hit 50 golf balls. That's a wild guess.
Okay,
and four of them I would say I hit very well. And I played baseball long enough, and I know enough about the idea of what you're supposed to do that I can kind of approximate it. The four times I hit a golf ball straight and far. You feel like Thor or something. You feel like, like I totally get why retired men love golf. It's because if your virility is fading and you're like the world is passing you by and you don't understand technology and you don't understand young people and you feel like you're not as strong and powerful and potent as you used to be. I totally get why you would want to play golf a lot, because if you're good at it, I mean, the golf ball just goes so far.
It does.
You can't believe how far it goes. And I don't know what, and I'm terrible. I don't know what I'm doing. And I still a couple times hit a golf ball, what looked to be, I'm not good at estimating distance, but I would guess I hit it about 7,000 yards.
I would imagine that's about right. That's probably
That's what it looked like to me. It looked like I hit the ball 7,000 yards.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I'm not a golfer. I don't play. I've played, one round of full golf. Well, not even full golf. One round in my life of golf. And it was at Augusta National. So I figure when I find...
There you go. You've done it. You've played golf.
I was going to say, I figured when I find another course better, I'll try that one. But it was cool. It was great. But I do like going out every now and again to a driving range. I think that's a totally different thing. I think... If golf people were smart, they would sell that thing. Like they would sell
that experience.
Right.
You mean
just going out, you don't have to chase it. You don't have to worry about if it's straight or not. Just come out, hit 100 golf balls. I think it's awesome. I love
it. And there's nets everywhere to the right and left of you. It's like you can't hurt anybody. And even when they go out to clean up the balls, they're in the guy's in a cage.
Right.
You can't hurt him.
No.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's very liberating. I also think, by the way, that it's a thing that is a good like stress reliever, I would guess.
Yeah.
Like I think the difference between a driving range and actual golf is a game that causes stress. It seems very stressful to play golf.
I think it's very stressful, yeah.
And like you miss an 8-foot putt and your blood pressure like boils over, you know? But that never happens when you're on a driving range.
No, no. It's
hit the ball as hard as you can.
And also, by the way, way shorter. Like you could go out there for whatever. You go out there for 20 minutes.
We were there for 20 minutes total, and it was delightful. Yeah, I had I really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Well, we are going to start as we often do with the Cleveland Browns update.
Let's check in on the Cleveland Browns. How are they doing?
I don't know if you've been following this, but the Browns lost again last week, and we actually have not done this for 2 weeks. We took Thanksgiving week off. They lost the week before that too. So the Browns are 0-11 now. They're 0 wins, 11 losses. There's nothing of particular interest that happened in either of the last two games. It wasn't like there was some funny, fun thing where they, you know, committed some 12 men on the field penalty, you know, and lost because of nothing. They just are not very good, and the other team was better in each of those cases. So you back on board? Can we get you? Can we get you back as a Browns fan?
No, I'm not. No, I'm still out. I heard it. So listening to the Dan Le Batard show on ESPN Radio, and they had an amazing stat. The point differential of the Miami Dolphins is they're only 8 points better than the Browns. And they have 4 wins.
Right.
And there's something so interesting about that in terms of like the futility of the Browns, because if there's only an 8 point difference now through whatever it is, 11 games,
right,
you're talking about less than a point a game in point differential. And yet the Dolphins somehow have 4 wins and the Browns have 0, and the Browns haven't even really been that close.
No,
right.
No, like, they've really had one game. They went to overtime against Tennessee.
Right.
And they, you know, they have games that are like, you know what they're really, really good at is they're really, really good at like making games look closer than they are. Like that's a Browns specialty. Like they'll lose by 13, but it's only because the other team doesn't care, or they'll lose by 3 because they scored a late touchdown when the game was already over and the other team had basically left the field. That's sort of like the game one of the year, they lost to Pittsburgh by 3 and sort of losing for a moment my Browns, you know, sort of spider senses. I kind of thought, oh, this is a good sign. They played Pittsburgh, you know, well, and Pittsburgh's a very good team. And they, you know, they came within 3. I mean, that's really good. And I just totally forgot that Pittsburgh won by 3 because that was what was most convenient at the time. There was no, they could have won by, if they were told, hey, it doesn't count unless you win by 20, they would have won by 20. But right, because 3 is as good as anything else, and everybody likes Hugh Jackson, nobody wants to run the score up on that guy. So they are a different kind of terrible. Like last year, they were terrible. They were 1-15 and really shouldn't have even won the game that they actually won. They needed the other team to miss a bunch of field goals and do a bunch of stupid things, whatever. But last year's team had like a, I don't know, like a hopelessness because they were so bad. This year's team is like, they're just losers. They just have this thing down pat. They know how to go in every game, play just well enough to lose without sort of totally embarrassing themselves. You know, every now and again, they will embarrass themselves because it's just sort of a natural thing. But like this past week's game against Cincinnati was as dry and uninteresting and sort of professional. It was a professional loss. They went out there and they're like, oh, this is what it's going to take to lose this game. We're willing to do that. And they just went out and
A workmanlike loss.
And that's where they are now, which is very sad. And I guess my question to you, if I had a question. So here's been my big sort of gripe about this team and the way they're sort of being treated. And, you know, I think you and I have discussed, I'm not a big fan of the way broadcasters tend to call NFL games because they're not the local affiliates, right? They're not the local announcers. So they have to sort of stay neutral and they don't want to offend either side. And I don't blame them. And that's the job. So they have to come in and they have to say nice things about the Browns, even though there's really nothing nice to say. And they have to, like, you know, say all kinds of ridiculous things about, oh, you you know, nobody blames Hugh Jackson for what's going on here. I mean, the guy's 1-26 as a head coach. I mean, you can give him a little blame, right? He could take a little bit of the blame if yeah. you want. But here's my question to you. The at least the Browns haven't quit yet theme, which is a weekly theme on television, usually in the postgame coverage, usually in the postgame press conferences, the players and Hugh Jackson and others will sort of brag, I got to say, sort of boast that, you know, this team won't quit. This team doesn't quit. They've been through a lot. They don't quit. How do you feel about the whole they didn't quit sort of cliche? Like, where do you stand on that?
Like most things like that, it appears to me to be a sort of empty platitude.
Yes.
Like I don't put any, even when it comes from like a player, like a former player, I don't believe it at all. I don't believe, I don't believe that people quit in general.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure some of them do, you know, and I'm sure that like, if you're playing for the 0-11 Browns and it's late in the third quarter and you're down by 18 and you know, you have no chance of coming back and you're on punt coverage, do I think you're going 100% all out sprinting down the field, like as a gunner and trying to make a desperate special teams tackle to limit the punt returner to a 2-yard punt return instead of a 7-yard punt return? No, probably not. Like your basic human instinct of survival will kick in and you'll think to yourself, nothing is going to change if I don't run as fast as I can on this punt. This guy's going to fair catch this anyway, right? Because it's like, there's why he's not going to risk a fumble.
Right.
So I'll run it 90% speed and not risk blowing out my hamstring. I think that happens all the time. I also don't happen to think that's quitting.
No, you know, no.
I think the actual idea of quitting is pretty rare. I think it does happen occasionally. Like, of course it does. And guys get demoralized or they just are selfish or they just, whatever the situation is, they end up sort of thinking like, I don't care. I'm not going to try hard. But most of these guys are competitive monsters who have been competitive and athletic all their lives,
right,
who live for the competition, who live for the moment of whatever it is they're doing, whether they're on the defensive line or their cornerbacks or their running backs or whatever. And most of them are going to try hard because they know that their futures, like people, coaches watch film and they care and whatever. So I think most of them are playing hard all the time. And I think when they're not playing as hard as they possibly can, I don't think that's quitting. And I think that the idea, this notion of like, well, at least they're not quitting. This team didn't quit. We didn't quit. It's kind of like, okay, great. I don't know what to make. I don't know that I care one way or the other about that. And I certainly don't think that the casual observer or even the intent observer has the ability to determine whether or not that is true.
That's right. That's right. You know, a few years ago, I've written about this a few times. Kansas State, when I was the columnist in Kansas City, Kansas State played Nebraska, and Kansas State was at that point getting to be very, very good. They were on the rise. They were climbing up to be very, very good. And Nebraska was the king of the hill then. I mean, they might have been even defending national champions. It was during the Tom Osborne stretch. And there was talk going in that Kansas State, hey, maybe they're going to pull even with Nebraska. Maybe they're good enough to play with Nebraska. And they weren't. Nebraska totally destroyed them in the game, just destroyed them. And after the game, somebody said to Bill Snyder, who was and actually still is the head coach at Kansas State, said to Bill, well, hey, you know, and it was sort of one of those, and as a reporter, I fully, you know, I appreciate this. You'll ask a question. You're not even, I don't even know why you're even asking it. You're just kind of asking it because it's so tense in the room after a loss. You're just trying to cut a little bit of that tension.
Sure.
So the question was something along the lines of, well, hey, you know, you have to say at least your guys didn't quit. And Bill Snyder gave the greatest response I've ever heard of that, which is he said that they don't let you quit. And which is right. They don't.
Right.
They don't let you just like leave the field and like, oh, we quit. The only player I've ever known to quit, as far as I would, you know, qualify the word quit. Do you remember Chester McLaughlin? Remember him, the defensive lineman?
Yeah.
He was a pretty good player.
Or something. Who did he play for?
He played for the Chiefs and the Raiders, and okay. He might have even played for other team, Denver, maybe later. I can't even remember. Anyway, he was a big guy, and he was pretty good, but he wasn't always the hardest working guy. He was the most polite. He never talked to the media, but he was the most polite non-media speaker ever. Like, you would go up to him and say, "Hey, Chester, you got a minute?" And he would say, no, thank you. No, thank you. No,
I like that.
No, thank you. Yeah, very polite.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Raiders were playing the Chiefs in a game, and this has never been confirmed, but I probably believe it. Reportedly, at one point, Chester McLaughlin said to the Chiefs offensive lineman, "Hey, don't cut block me. I'm signing with you guys next year." Like that. That is quitting. Like, that is the kind of thing I think of when I think of quitting. I, you know, the Browns, are they quitting? Look, if you quit, you get caught in this league. Yeah. I mean, there's not like a lot of like wiggle room. If they see you out there, like not playing, not even trying, I mean, there are not that many jobs in this league. So I don't think that you quit, but you use the word demoralize. And I think that's quitting.
Yeah.
That's, to me, is the closest thing to quitting, is you get so demoralized. You're like, well, yeah, I'm playing hard, but I know we're not going to win. And that's where I think the Browns are.
Right? Yeah. I think that like quitting is in the Pro Bowl when.
Right. There you go.
They snap the ball and the defensive line just kind of stands up and waves at the offensive line with their arms, kind of like, we're rushing the quarterback. Like, because none of these guys are, they're all smart and they're not going to blow out their knees or shoulders or something in the Pro Bowl. It's why the Pro Bowl is unwatchably boring and why they've had such problems with it, is because you can't have, it's impossible to do it. You cannot have a Pro Bowl. The only person who ever took the Pro Bowl seriously ever was Sean Taylor. Sean Taylor famously in the Pro Bowl just lit somebody up on like punt coverage that one year. It's an amazing video because he was a monster, a competitive monster who didn't matter where he was. He was like, I'm going to play as hard as I can all the time. And you have many times told the wonderful story about Tony Gonzalez. It's a great story. Look it up. You can read. Joe wrote this story about Tony Gonzalez and Bill Belichick at the Pro Bowl. So like that to me is, that's what quitting is. Quitting is like, I'm very visibly not trying. And you know, everything else beyond that is a platitude being offered by a person, by an analyst who doesn't know what else to say about a team that's 0-11.
That's right. That's what it is, where you are just run out of things to say, but I just wish they'd stop saying that. I wish they would come up with a new platitude, which I get it. There's nothing really all that interesting to say about the Browns right now. They're tanking. They're hoping that they're going to have a great draft next year and they can start turning this thing around. We all know where they are, but stop saying they're not, that they quit. That
you know what would be funny? I had this thought after the Giants announced they were benching Eli, was, you know, Eli very famously, there's a couple interesting things about that. Number one, his benching, he had the current record of consecutive starts at like 210, and now quitting.
That's right.
That record, that the longest streak now goes to Philip Rivers, who of course is the guy that the Chargers drafted when Eli refused to be drafted by the Chargers. So that's kind of an interesting little side note. Also, Philip Rivers and Eli Manning are neck and neck in terms of like career stats, and not neck and neck, but they're close in a bunch of categories. And if Eli now doesn't have a starting job and doesn't play for the rest of the year, it's possible that Philip Rivers is going to like pass him in like career passing yards and stuff. Like these two guys have had these weirdly parallel careers. And I think ultimately you'd probably take Eli's career over Philip Rivers just because of the two Super Bowl wins. But Philip Rivers has been a better quarterback. He's been a better regular season quarterback. He's been a steadier quarterback. And most of his stats are better than Eli's, I believe. But the interesting thing is that, you know, he refused to sign with the Chargers in part because the Chargers are so bad the year that they came out in the draft. But now you wonder, like, would he, if it's the end of the road for Eli in New York, where does he go? And one of the places he could go is Cleveland. You know what I mean? Like, it would be so ironic if Cleveland, who is desperate for any kind of like minor competency at quarterback, what if Cleveland said to him, hey, we'll give you a 4-year deal $25 million guaranteed a year just to come and like be a professional quarterback, a thing we have never had
for 1 year.
Basically for 1 year. Right. Yeah. I mean, would you do it? I think I would do it if I were Eli. Like, why not? Right. Like,
I would do it if I were Cleveland. Yeah. I'd do it for both. I mean, why not? Look, the thing about Eli is you and I actually have had conversations about Eli. Eli's career is weird. It's one of the weirdest careers because he has not been a particularly good regular right. season quarterback at any point really in his career, but he was amazing on both of those playoff runs. I mean, you can't take it away from him. And he is, from what I can tell, from everything I can gather about him, he's like the most stand-up guy like on planet Earth. I mean, they're benching him for Geno Smith, for God's sake. And yet he's like handled it. He's like, hey, look, that's, you know, I'm just here to just make everybody happy. I totally respect that. So that, you know, he would absolutely insert like a level of he'd be terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Browns, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah. Just well, terrible. Yeah, but they would win. They would, it would bring, if he were the quarterback of the Browns, they would win 3 to 5 games. Look, don't you think?
That's right. If yeah. if he was a quarterback this year, yeah. they'd win
yeah.
3 games.
I think, I mean, their quarterback yeah. play has been so bad and so abysmal for so long. Like, I mean, they haven't yes. had anything approaching league average quarterback play really forever. And no. so a league average quarterback wins 6 games in the league, especially now that like they've got some legitimately good players on defense. They've got like, if Joe Thomas came back, they have, you know, and is okay. Right. They, you know, who knows who they draft next year. They've got a bunch of draft choices. They've got high draft choices. They've got, you know, first round picks and second round picks and whatever. Yeah. So I don't know. There's nothing behind this theory. It was just interesting to think about the fact that Eli sidestepped an organization that he felt wasn't up to the Manning standards, which is kind of a jerky thing. Elway did the same thing too. And when he came out I hate that. Yes, I think that stinks. I think it's, I think it's BS. And I always, even though you're right, I've heard that he's a stand-up guy, blah, blah, blah. I still hold it against him that he orchestrated that trade.
That's right.
So it would be interesting if he ended his career with the worst team in the history of football.
I think that whole organization at some point is just moving east. I mean, moving west to Cleveland. Any coaching staff that would pull this off in like this late in the year where it doesn't matter, just yeah. bench the guy and break a streak for
zero
no reason other than yeah. zero. That's any organization that would do that. That they have a future in Cleveland, in my view.
But you know what's weird too is not to like derail this thing too much, but it's so weird to me that like if the guy were, you know, Kaepernick for the 49ers a few years ago, or Pat Mahomes for Kansas City or whatever. Wait, it's not Pat Mahomes, is it? Pat Mahomes was the pitcher.
Right? It's his son.
Oh, is it really? Yeah. Is it Pat Mahomes?
Yeah, I think there it's you his go. Son.
In other words, if it's like a guy who you're like, we're anxious to take this new Ferrari out onto the,
right, that's
onto
right.
the track.
That's right. Totally
then fine. But it's not. It's Geno Smith. You know what Geno Smith is. There's a lot of evidence of what Geno Smith is. Like, well, I don't. That's why this is so baffling to me. Is it's not. They're not even benching him for like, look, this is the guy who's our future. We need to see what we have
right,
here. They
right.
know what they have, and it's not any good. You know, that's what's so vexing about it, and makes me feel like there's more to it somehow. Maybe. Or something. I don't know.
But I think
that was the true baffling thing to me is like it's you know, when Parcells had Romo like kicking around as a backup and people were clamoring to get Romo in there, and then they finally got Romo in there, and you were like, oh man, like this guy's great. Yeah. This guy's really good.
Yeah.
That's not the case here.
No.
And so that's why I don't just let him finish the year. Who cares? They're not making the playoffs. It's 5 more games. Let him finish the year and then do it. You know,
it makes no sense. It makes no sense. All right. Amazingly, neither of us watch the NFL, and yet we spent.
That's
half
right.
This
we just talked about 25 minutes
of the NFL. I want to talk about the Hall of Fame. There's not a lot of baseball to talk about. We could talk a little bit about this, about, you know, potentially Giancarlo Stanton getting moved, which is obviously very interesting, and
very
your Red Sox could be potentially in the mix there. We could talk about Otani. Who is coming over from Japan, and everybody has put in apparently written requests to him, right? To sort right. of tell them you know, what or what the organization would be like for him. And that's really exciting to see Shohei Ohtani come over. But I want to talk for a minute because I think this is directly you're directly involved in this for reasons that will become obvious. Last week, Joe Morgan, the Hall of Fame second baseman, and also not incidentally the vice chairman of the Hall of Fame and a prominent board member of the Hall of Fame, sent out a long letter to every member of the Baseball Writers Association of America, the people who vote for the Hall of Fame. I'm one of those. He sent us all a letter from the Baseball Hall of Fame email address. So when we got the email address, it said Joe Morgan's letter, but it was from the Baseball Hall of Fame. And the letter was a passionate plea, and you can read it. It's out there. It's on my website. It's everywhere. A passionate plea to people to not vote for steroid users for the Hall of Fame, that they don't belong there. They have no business there, that the Hall of Fame is a special and sacred place, and please don't ruin it. And there was also in there, by the way, a pretty direct threat that several of the Hall of Famers have said, if any of these guys do get elected, that they will not show up at the Hall of Fame. So they will boycott or whatever you want to call it. You have a history with Joe Morgan that people might be aware of.
That makes it sound like he and I dated briefly in the 90s or something.
Well, you sort of did actually date for a little while. So the two questions for you, and these are questions that people have actually poured in to me for our listener questions thing, which will come up shortly, but also just generally, the two questions are, one, what did you think of the Joe Morgan whole thing? What's your take on it? And secondly, will you bring back Fire Joe Morgan just for that letter? That's the big questions.
Okay. I think it's deeply, deeply insane that he did this. Yeah, I think it's insane no matter which angle you attack it from. So let's start with an angle in a world in which I did not co-author a website called Fire Joe Morgan for 5 years, in which he was a frequent target of our analysis. Analysis is a kind word for how we approach his writing and his speaking. But let's just say I have no dog in this fight. It's insane, even right. If you don't care about Joe Morgan one way or the other, for the simple reason that he is powerful voice at the Hall of Fame. He is an incredibly well-respected player and figure in the game of baseball, and certainly and specifically around the idea of the Hall of Fame, which means he can circulate that argument privately to anyone he wishes. And he didn't. He very deliberately made it public. He decided he knew exactly what he was doing. He was making it like you pointed out. He sent it from the Hall of Fame email address. He was saying, this is the official position of the people who were in the Hall of Fame, who care about the Hall of Fame. It wasn't even a warning shot across the bow. It was a shot. He was firing at the hull of the BBWAA. It's such a weird thing to do, because you don't need, it's like, why be public about it? Why take this stance unless you are so over the top crazed with your opinion that you feel like you need to shout it from the rooftop? There is no one was asking this question. And not only that, but the people who, there are how many, 15 guys right now who would normally have been in the Hall of Fame based on their numbers and aren't because of steroids, including, by the way, Barry. Obviously, this is about Bonds and Clemens. Mostly, this is about Bonds and Clemens.
Right.
But how many other guys are there? Manny Ramirez and Rafael Palmeiro and Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa. There are so many guys who would have instantly been elected if not for the fact that the world of the voting body had already come to this conclusion, at least in some level. Now, granted, Bonds and Clemens have been inching up, right? Clemens especially, he's been inching forward, right, in the last couple of votes. There's guys who are getting close.
They both, right? That's right. They both top 50% right. this year.
So they're in, so maybe that's why he felt like I gotta nip this in the bud or something. But even given that, the idea of doing it so publicly and so volatilely and causing stirring up so many passions is crazy. And I think, frankly, my guess is, and I have nothing to base this on, this is a wild speculation, I'll bet this did more to hurt his cause than to help it, because I don't think people like a scold and they don't like being lectured to, and the world and the people who vote on these things, I would guess, feel like they can make up their own minds about this. And they, and it's like he did this from a position of someone in a very, in a world gone by, in a bygone era where like the word comes down from on high from a respected source and everyone just falls in line. And I don't think the world works that way anymore. And if I were in the BBWAA and I had a vote and anyone told me what to think or how to behave or what I should, how I should be approaching this, I would lose my mind and I would want to vote the other way just on principle. So it's crazy in that sense. That's the like neutral crazy. And then there's a specific crazy, which is the idea that there is a right way to approach the Hall of Fame voting with this specific issue, with the specific issue of performance enhancers. And the reason it's insane is because Joe Morgan knows as well as anybody that as long as there have been players and as long as there have been substances that those players can take to improve their performance, players have taken substances. It was amphetamines. In the super old days, it was cocaine, just straight up cocaine. You know what I mean? It's greenies, it's Ritalin, it's whatever exists. Because again, these people are competitive monsters. They have taken those things. And the idea that baseball used to be this bastion of pure athletic competition, like in ancient Greece or something, and not always a substance riddled competitive atmosphere, is so insulting. It's deeply insulting because everyone knows the stories. They're out there. People have talked about it openly. As long as there have been performance enhancing substances of any kind, athletes have taken them in every sport. So the idea like that this is, he's calling upon an era and invoking an era of purity and of athletic competition without any kind of enhancement that never existed. It just never existed. And so it's insulting for that reason too, to suggest that there are people, that people are so blind to what used to happen in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and whatever, that they were like, oh, you know what? He's right. It used to be this pure thing that was only about the athletes and wasn't about, you know, drugs. And that's just not true. And you can have a reasonable debate about whether amphetamines did the same thing for you that steroids did, or the cream and the clear. And maybe that's maybe you can, you know, draw a line of distinction between those things. That's fine. If you, however you want to approach it, man, it's like the world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want, but he is not doing that. He is saying until the moment that this era of players started using steroids, there has never been a cheater. No one ever cheated. And for that reason, we can draw this absolute rigid line of demarcation in the Hall of Fame between good players who didn't cheat and bad players who did cheat. And that is absolutely absurd. And I literally, it drove me up the wall when I read that. I could not believe what I was reading.
Yeah, it's stunning. There are a couple of points I want to make on following up what you were saying. First point I want to make is, and I will readily admit that I'm a little bit in the minority on this opinion, just on the and nothing that I disagree with you on at all, but except for what is going to be the outcome of this letter, there are a lot of people in the BBWAA, people around the BBWAA, commentators who believe that this will have a backfiring effect, that people will read this, be really offended. That's certainly how I felt. And they're going to just strengthen their point of view, which is, you know, I think there's a lot of logic behind that. I actually think this is going to have a very, very, very strong impact the other way. And here's why I think that. I think there are a lot of people, and maybe this was the whole point of the letter, to be honest. I think there were a lot of people who they don't really want to vote for Barry Bonds. They don't really want to vote for Roger Clemens, but they sort of see the way the wind is blowing. They see that people are kind of going, hey, you know what? I mean, we're not saying what they did was right. What we're saying is that they were the greatest players of their time, and that's what the Baseball Hall of Fame is. And you can't start there and stuff us with morality. We all know about the morality of baseball players through the years. And by the way, you mentioned the ancient Olympics. I did a story. Those guys used to take illegal substances. That was like a thing. Like in the during
of course
the
they did. Yes,
Olympics.
Right. Of course. Exactly. What was I thinking? Of course they did. They were athletes.
They were athletes.
Yeah, they would crack open some weird root that they gave them a temporary burst of energy and
exactly
snort it. Yeah,
right. Exactly right. So, I think those people are looking for cover. I think those people have been looking for cover for a while. I think they've wanted the Hall of Fame to give a directive. I think this is a directive. I don't think this is just Joe Morgan. I think this is sort of the official position of the Hall of Fame, even though they are like, they love to hide behind Joe Morgan, and I don't blame them. I mean, why wouldn't you? But this is how they feel. This is how the Hall of Fame, I think this is how the Hall of Fame feels. And I know this is how Joe Morgan feels. And I know this is the way a lot of Hall of Famers feel, which, by the way, all due respect to the Hall of Famers, they should have no business whatsoever, in my view, in determining who comes after them in the Hall of Fame. I mean,
100%. That's a great point that I totally forgot to mention is what gives you the right as to weigh in on this at all.
Right.
That's not okay. You like, I mean, you if you want to, it's a free country, but like you should not. It should not be the case that the people who get in then get to close the door behind them. That's
right.
Not how this works. This is you are the guest at the Hall of Fame, and this is an independent body, allegedly an independent body who's deciding on people's worthiness. And it's absurd and kind of a little bit unethical for those people to be leveraging their fame and authority to influence the voting body. That's crazy. And then there's also the whole issue that which we haven't even talked about yet of, well, what is the Hall of Fame?
That's right.
Right? This is the Hall of Fame. The Baseball Hall of Fame is not a group of people to whom we are entrusting like the future of humanity, right? This isn't like we're electing 1,000 people to board a space ark to fly to a new planet and start a new society.
That would
we need
be awesome,
only the most
though.
Ethical and beautiful, perfect people who have the most pure souls. Like, that's not what we're doing. We're telling the story of the history of this sport. And like, and I get it, character matters, but as you and I have talked about many times, okay, then how about Ty Cobb, right? How about like all of the people, whoever, and some of the stories about Ty Cobb, which we now know are apocryphal, but he wasn't a great guy. And a lot of the guys, right, a lot of the people from that era are not great guys. There are inveterate racists in the Hall of Fame. There are people who like abused women and abused drugs. So many people. So the idea that one of the guys who's in the Hall of Fame could make the argument of like, well, no cheaters. I mean, that is just my blood is boiling all over again.
Well, and there's a second part of it. That's what I was going to say. That's the first thing. The second thing is, there are steroid users in the Hall of Fame. We know that. We know that. Look, I voted for them. I have voted for steroid users that are now in the Hall of Fame. I wouldn't say no doubt. I never say no doubt. I have almost no doubt that there are people that we have voted in the last few years, probably people that we voted in a lot earlier than that. I'm not even going to talk about what potentially could have happened in the 70s and 80s. We love to believe steroids were invented in 1994, but that's not how it worked. And there were people using steroids in the 50s, and that, you know, we know Mickey Mantle kind of played around with steroids at one point for his knee. I mean, this is a long-standing thing. But there are steroid users in the Hall of Fame. So we've decided to sort of slam the door now. So what? So there are no more steroid users in the Hall of Fame? I mean,
should we do an audit? Should we go back through everybody and do like hire what's the guy?
Starr.
Yeah, hire Ken Starr or Pash, whatever that guy's name is, who did the Deflategate investigation, and comb through handwritten notes.
Boy, they would not want that. They would.
Like,
not
did Pi Trainer ever ever write a letter to a girl saying like, I tried a new substance called cocaine, it gave me a lot of bursts of energy. Like, I mean, that's the other thing is there has been no system in place to test people, to care about this one way or the other. And now to all of a sudden say it's a lie, it's an absolute litmus test is so crazy. It's so unreliable. Everything about it is wrong and bad, and it shouldn't have happened.
It's awful. It's awful. So will you bring Fire Joe Morgan back from the grave?
No, it was a lot of people. I knew something weird had happened because I went to Twitter and I had like 52 messages from right. people going like, hey, you've got to come back. I was oh no, what did Joe
love to run it.
What
did Joe love to do? Run that.
let this podcast serve as my Fire Joe Morgan fisking.
Yeah, no, it's here's the thing. I mean, this is a complicated issue, and you know, we've talked about this. Look, you have very mixed feelings about it. Very mixed feelings about the guys who use steroids. I don't, and I think we all yeah. have some. You know, I mean, I think yours are even more mixed than mine. Mine are a little less mixed, only because I feel like before there was testing, I just don't think if you're not going to test the players, you're telling them it's okay to use it. And if you're telling them it's okay to use it, they're going to use it. There's just no question. I totally credit those that didn't. I do. I think they were sure. wonderful. I don't know who they are. I wouldn't know who they are if they told me. You know what I mean? I mean, this is nobody has admitted basically other than Mark McGwire, who's that poor guy. He's like the only guy who's ever been like, you know, asked to admit it. And he actually did in a tearful way. And everybody's like, shut up. You know, I mean, it was that he got no credit whatsoever for actually admitting he used it.
Although I have to say it was a bad admission.
It wasn't a full.
I'm not here to talk about the past kind of a thing.
Well, I mean, it was the whole thing was about admitting using it.
Yeah, I know.
He refused to do. And I don't know if he would do it now. I mean, I'm sure he's happy. It's all behind him. What he refused to do was admit that they played a huge role in his career.
I felt very strongly like there was a missed opportunity for someone. A-Rod almost did it, but in classic A-Rod fashion, he ended up weirdly bungling it in a terrible, humiliating, awkward way. I felt like there was a space for a while back then for some big famous player to come out and say, okay, here's the deal. I used all of this stuff. Why did I use it? Because there was no one was looking. No one cared. It was absolute benign neglect. It was the same benign neglect that led to the American Revolution. It was no one seemed to care. Everyone was turning a blind eye. And I did a simple calculation in my head. And that calculation was I could take these drugs that no one seems to care about whether I take them and be better at this thing that I do and make $1 billion doing it. Or I cannot do that and watch as every other person does it instead of me.
Right.
So I did it. And I did it, and it was bad, and it was wrong, and I'm really sorry. And if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't do it again. Even if they don't mean that, they should say that. By the way,
you have to say
that. and here's the culture. Here's why it happened. I'm not going to ever name names. I feel like it's up to everyone individually to decide whether you want to admit that you did it or not. But I did it, and I'm really sorry. And I apologize to everyone that I hurt by doing this. And like a current player doing that would have been a big deal. And there were some versions of it and stuff, but it was they were always tainted, right? It was always Canseco did it because he was trying to hawk his book.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah. You know, Canseco doesn't even count. You know, I mean, look, I think the closest guy, and again, people will disagree with me on this. I think the closest guy was McGwire. I think McGwire, he took a full hour to sort of explain that he did it, say he was sorry, say he regretted it, say he wanted to make it right and talk to kids about steroid use and all that. The thing he was unwilling to do was talk about how it made him so much stronger and made him so – because he kind of kept coming back like, well, you know, I worked really hard on my hitting. And it's like nobody cares. No, it just you've got to – you're already in. To me, he were already all the way in anyway. Just go all the way in, and he wouldn't do it. And I, you know, that's, he's got to take the fault for that. But he still went miles and miles further than anybody else. None of these, every other one, even when they're admitting, it's like, well, I admit it, I did it, but I didn't even know. My trainer made me do it, and I didn't. It was some sort of cream. I thought it was something else. I mean, nobody else will admit it. And it's sad. It shows real weakness on their parts. So this is a complicated issue, but the last thing we needed for a very complicated issue that people have been thinking about for 10 years were somebody to just throw from an official Hall of Fame, sort of high post, you know, really pretty high up in the Hall of Fame world, to throw down these ancient arguments about the greatness of the game and the sacred nature of the Hall of Fame. Just gross. Just ugh.
Yeah. Boo. Yeah.
It was not fun. Not fun. All right. Let's go to listener questions. We got a bunch of listener questions from people. So let's just begin with Bees. Bees, B-E-E-Z, would like to know, when should you arrive at a work Christmas party, and how long should you stay at a minimum?
I would say you should arrive about half an hour after it starts.
That's right. I actually had it at about half an hour to an hour after it starts.
Yeah. You cannot be the first person there. You have to guarantee that there's like 12 other people there already. And then minimum, let's say, okay, we're going to say, for the purposes of this argument, this is a standard kind of 7 to 10:30 kind of a deal.
3.5-4 hour thing, I think. That's right.
Okay, so here's the move. Let's say it's 7 to 10:30. You show up at 7:30.
Right.
And you tell people, I can't stay that long because I have to meet my friend who's in town for like a late dinner, right? And then if the party's really fun, you go, screw that, friend. I'm sticking here. I'm going to go to the party because this is fun. And if it's not fun, you at 8:30, you go like, I'm so sorry, I have to leave, but I got to get out of here, meet my friend. And you leave. So I would say you show up a half an hour late and you stay for an hour.
An hour. That's what.
And then if it's really fun, you stick around for as long as you want.
What are the odds? What are the odds of that being like, you know, this is not like your manager of the year party. I mean, this is a Christmas party for some work.
Well, who knows, though? What if your office is super fun? I mean, I've like, you know, if there's a good office Christmas party isn't a common occurrence, but it has happened.
Okay, maybe. 7:30, you arrive for a 7 o'clock. I agree. You are allowed to leave at any point once everyone has arrived. Like once sort of like, like the last straggler shows in, which I think will be about 8:30. It's about an hour. In fact, it's not a bad idea, like when the last straggler walks in, for you to sort of be walking out and like pass that person and be like, come on, man. I mean, you know, it's a Christmas party, you know?
Yep.
And then keep walking.
You can do the calculation by how you can leave as soon as you have like officially said hello to and chatted to whoever the people are feel like you should chat with and say hello to, your boss, your superior, your advisor, your coworkers, whatever. I once attended an event that I really didn't want to attend. And there were, I think, four people who were like important people that I had to like see and say hello to. And I walked in and I saw the first one right away. And I said, hey, how's it going? And the person said, it's going great. Thanks. How are things? I was like, great. And he was like, I'm sorry, I just got to run over there real quick. And I was like, no problem. Take your time. He left. I kept walking. I saw that the other three people were talking to each other. I stopped. Hello. We chatted for about a minute and a half. It was great. One of them said, I'm going to go get a drink. I said, oh, okay, cool. I went, saw the fourth person. I was like, oh my God, I've seen all four. I've been here for 5 minutes. I've seen all four people. I talked to the fourth person for a little while. I like these people. It's not like I don't like them. Sure. I chatted with the fourth person for like a good 3 or 4 minutes. And then we split up. That person went to go talk to somebody else. I went to go talk to somebody else. And I realized I can leave.
You're free.
And
you're totally free.
I walked out and I got back down to the valet where the event was being held. And my car was still there. There was such a backlog of cars. They hadn't even parked my car yet. And I went up to the guy and I was like, that's my car. Can I just get out of here? And the guy was like, yeah, sure. Go ahead. And I just got my car and I got home and my wife was like, what happened? And I was like, I saw everybody I needed to see in 5 minutes. And I came home. It's the best. It's one of my fondest Hollywood memories. It really is. It was like that. It was so wonderful. I was like watching Netflix with my wife at like 8:23 after an event that started at 8.
That is the best. That is honestly my dream. I hate parties. I don't like them. I'm not good in crowds. None of it works for me. And I have to go to a lot of like fundraisers and things like that. I'm sure you do too. I don't like them. And you know, I do my best I can. But if I ever had that opportunity where I'm like, oh, I've seen the four people and I'm out. Oh, that's the dream.
It was wonderful.
All right, Liberal Jones wants to know, what is the best color sticky note?
The answer is yellow. I'm sorry.
I don't even think there's not even another option.
The other ones are useful in certain situations, but like yellow, and the reason is because most pens are dark blue or black, and right. You need the writing to be in contrast. And the red ones and the blue ones and the green ones, there just isn't enough contrast for the pen. So like it's hacky choice, but that's the right answer.
I think it's yellow. I think the only, I mean, look, those others do have their uses, but often their uses are not even, you don't even write on them. You're just using them to.
Like tabs, right? Exactly. Like in a long document. You're like, I'm going to put the yellow ones where I need to sign. I'll put the blue ones where someone else needs to sign or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. But for everyday use, yellow's the right color.
Yellow's the right color. Trey wants to know, who would be more successful, Papa John running an NFL team or Jerry Jones running his own pizza company?
Oh, man.
I love this question.
Oh, what a great question. Oh, boy. Okay. Now, let's start by defining successful, okay. Right? Because Jerry Jones is very successful as a Cowboys owner and Papa John's is very successful as a pizza owner.
Right.
But Papa John's pizza is terrible and the Cowboys are terrible. So the successful, they're both successful in that they have a lot of money and power and stuff, but their product is often very bad.
Right.
So the question is, when you say successful, do you mean like if Papa John ran a football franchise, would it continue to like accrue in value? Or do you mean he like wins playoff games and maybe gets a Super Bowl? I think that's how you have to look at it, right?
It's right. But it's a good question. That's a tough break. Cause again, is Jerry Jones a successful coach? I mean, he certainly in his early days won his Super Bowls, but hasn't done anything for whatever, 20 years or whatever. I'm going to say it is like, I think you would have to just define success the way that you defined it just now, that Papa John is successful. Because the hope that either one of them would be artistically successful is hopeless. It's hopeless. There's no way that Papa John's football team is going to win. And there's no way that Jerry Jones could make a good pizza. So the question is, who would be more successful within those parameters?
I think it's got to be Jerry Jones. I think Papa John doesn't have any idea what he's doing in any direction. I really don't. I think he's a man. He is a man at sea. And I think, and I also, by the way, think it's probably harder to own and run a football team than it is to like run a pizza franchise, because there's pizza franchising is like a restaurant franchise. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm totally wrong. You know, here's the thing. I'm gonna change. I'm gonna say Papa John, because I feel like there are owners who are hands off owners, right?
That's right.
There's owners who just are like, I own the team. I'll hire people who are like have a good track record, and then they get lucky in the draft. And Jerry Jones has his greatest sin is micromanaging, right? He's the guy who had to be physically restrained from drafting Johnny Manziel because he's so bad at his own job, which is understanding what football is. So and he's constantly like on the sidelines and he's like weighing in on issues. And I feel like that would be a disaster, because he wouldn't know anything about the pizza business. And so he would like micromanage this business he didn't know anything about. And that would be even worse than him micromanaging football, which he ostensibly does know something about. So I would say if Papa John bought a team and then were just an owner who just was like hands off and hired, you know, people who were decent then he'd probably be more successful. It's also easier to be a football owner because you just don't do anything and your investment makes money.
Right. I think Papa John hires, he hires Peyton Manning and one of his other buddies, right? And just says, you guys run this team.
Yeah, he hires John Elway and Peyton Manning. And they just goes like, you guys do whatever. I'll be up here eating. I now have the opportunity to eat good pizza for once.
Jerry Jones would not know how to even start on the pizza.
No, he would be like mixed. He would go to like a Papa John's franchise in St. Louis and be like, you guys are making this pizza wrong. And he would, but we need more cayenne pepper or whatever. And he would just ruin. He would ruin everything.
All right. We have another either or. Ian wants to know who would be a more successful Major League Baseball manager, the Grinch or Santa Claus?
Oh, the Grinch, right?
I don't even think that's close. I don't think Santa Claus would be a good Major League
Baseball. Santa Claus would be a terrible manager. Yeah. Oh God, no, because he has no ability to like discern. He sees the best in everybody and wants everyone to succeed and be happy. I mean, forget it. No, the Grinch at least has like a pessimistic outlook. I mean, look, here's the reason that you say the Grinch is Bill Belichick. And I know it's a different sport. But like Bill Belichick is the actual Grinch, and he's the most successful football coach in history.
That is so totally right. In fact, I don't know that you can be successful coaching any sport without having 67% Grinch in you.
Yeah, like, you've got to have a generally pessimistic attitude. You've got to expect the worst. You've got to also be tough and I mean, the Santa Claus is never cutting a guy who deserves to be cut because he's like, oh, well, how can I do that to him? He has a wife and children. Like,
I don't know though. Santa Claus, he will do the coal and for the bad. You know, he does like break it up between good and bad. I mean,
do you know anyone who actually got coal? That's a threat. Santa was always like, oh, Billy's been a good boy. I'll give him a present. Like, forget it. No, it's absolutely the Grinch. No question. It's the Grinch,
100%. I totally agree. All right. DeShama wants to know how much, if at all, was The Good Place inspired by Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks movie?
It really wasn't. In fact, if anything, I had to be, because I had seen Defending Your Life and I remembered it and I watched it after I wrote the pilot. I watched it again. I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I watched it again just to make sure that I wasn't stepping on anything. It's about purgatory and there's like, you know, lawyers and advocates who are sort of like weighing your soul and deciding whether you need to go give it another shot or whatever. So I was fairly confident that I had sidestepped anything. I mean, there's a couple other movies I did that with, what's it called? What's the Warren Beatty?
Heaven Can Wait.
Heaven Can Wait. I watched that. I had never seen that before, and I watched that
one. What did you think of Heaven Can Wait? That's in the 70s genre that you're not crazy about.
Yeah, it seems a little dated, right? That was the main thing I thought was kind of dated. It's very hard to have any comedy hold up for longer than about 10 years,
it's frankly. It's so true.
Yeah, and the other thing about Defending Your Life, and I don't want to slam it or anything, but they had Meryl Streep in that movie, and boy, does she not get anything to do. She just like her main purpose is to laugh at Albert Brooks's terrible jokes. And I just was like, how can you get Meryl Streep in your movie and then not give her anything to do? Like it's really weird. It's like weird, like a unforced error to not allow Meryl Streep to act in a movie. She doesn't get to act. She doesn't do anything. She goes to a comedy club with him and just laughs and is like, oh, this food is so good. And this is so good. And this is so good. And this is great. And she just finds everything he says charming for no reason at all. And there's a lot of movies like that where women who are way more sophisticated, intelligent, and attractive than the men they were paired up with just found the men endlessly fascinating and funny and charming and have no characters of their own,
the Woody Allen
like Diane Keaton is always like, oh, I'm completely in love with you for no reason.
I did like Defending Your Life. I enjoyed it. I think it's a good movie, and it's been a few years since I've seen it, but I really, really enjoyed it. But I did have that exact same feeling, which is this could have been literally, you could have just like walked into any casting room like on Earth and hired you. Like, why did you need Meryl Streep for this? And why did she take it? Like, why did she see that script and go, oh, I can see some things I can do with this
character? I think the idea at the time was extremely fresh and interesting and new.
Maybe that's true.
And also Albert Brooks, look, Albert Brooks is great. He's a genius. He's a super funny, interesting guy. There is one thing in that movie that really bothered me, which I had forgotten, which is the beginning of the movie is he's buying a Porsche, I think. And a
Mercedes.
Mercedes, right. Yeah. A fancy sports car, right? And he's driving down the street and he's like listening to music and then he like drops something and he reaches down to get it.
And he
gets into a car crash, right? But then the character, the movie is about the reason that he's in trouble in purgatory is that the angel lawyer people determined that he lived his life in fear,
right,
that he's too scared. And I was like, well, no, he didn't. He was a kind of a D-bag like guy wearing like sunglasses, buying a fancy sports car. Like, that's not a like why? How do you miss that? The beginning should have been he was buying a Volvo.
Right.
And his friend said, no, get a sports car. You deserve it. You make a lot of money. And he's like, no, Volvo. They're the safest cars. And they have the best crash rating. And so I'm going to get the sensible car. And then he still died. And then it would have made sense. But it doesn't make sense. He was not a person who seemed to be scared of anything. He was a guy who seemed to be kind of a jerk who then just got into a car crash. And I was like, well, that's such a weird thing to
That's to a really blow. Good point.
Yeah, very odd. I had forgotten that was how it started. And I don't know. I don't know why I'm slamming the life now.
No, look, I think it's very funny and has some wonderful moments in it. But the Meryl Streep thing has bothered me. It's just like, and look, she's fine in it. I mean,
she's
it's
totally,
like,
she's Meryl Streep. She's great in everything she ever does, but it's like, I describe her character. She's like, she's an amazing person. That's the end of her character.
That's it. All right. Lightning round. Five quick questions. Jared, what is your favorite sports video game ever?
Ooh, ever.
Yeah, well, unless you have one now.
No, it's RBI Baseball for the old Nintendo.
That was his prediction. I'm going to guess it's RBI Baseball for you both. For me, it's actually Tecmo Super Bowl is my favorite. I love RBI Baseball as well.
I played that when I was a kid. I didn't have a Nintendo. My mom didn't let me have one. But whenever I could play at a friend's house, I always played RBI Baseball. And then Seth Meyers, when I got to SNL, talked about how he and his friends used to play RBI Baseball all the time. So we bought on eBay a vintage Nintendo and RBI Baseball, and we played each other so much. So we played a world. Yeah, I was the Red Sox. I got to be the Red Sox, and he played the Astros, which was the best NL team probably. The Astros or the Mets, and we played a World Series, and then we played a World Series of World Series. So we played best of seven World Series. And then we played so much, it ended up being a World Series of World Series of World Series.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And we kept score. And when he got married, I presented him with the stack of paper that we had kept score on.
Who won the World Series of World Series of World Series?
I won the World Series of World Series of World Series, four World Series of World Series to two World Series of World Series.
The ability that you had to make a pitch literally drop is still my favorite part of the RBI.
Oh, it's the best. And bend to the side. Yeah, exactly. It's the best.
Just like, it just dropped. And you see that little bink when it hits the ground. Oh, I love it.
And also the way that when a player made an error, he shimmied back and forth like he was vibrating.
It's so great. I could talk about this for hours. That when a ball, especially when it was a line drive, it would like boing, like it would just hit him. It was like hitting
just,
a bell.
And then just kind of like stay in front of him, like just like a couple tantalizing inches in front of the vibrating error prone player.
Matt wants to know, is Cheeto a chip? Does that count as a chip?
That's tough. I think so, right?
I
mean, a chip you can dip it in things. Right. And some people do.
You can dip it.
You can't really put anything on it. You know, you can't put like an object on it, though.
Yeah,
you can't make nachos with. I don't know. It's really tough. What do you think? I'm kind of 50-50 here.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, when I first read that question just now, my first thought was no, it's not a chip. It's not. It's like its own thing. It's like its own. It's like a. I don't even know what you would call those. Like a puff. It's like a, you know, it's like a, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, is it, how expansive do we want to make the chip?
Well, I think if it's not a chip, you got to tell me what it is. You know what I mean? Like, I think if you take the position that it's not a chip, you got to tell me, okay, then you got to tell me what it is.
Could it not just be a Cheeto? Could Cheetos not be its own category? Like, and then other things like Cheetos would be like puffy things would be like Cheetos.
I mean, I feel like you could make that argument and Goodell is going to come down on you like a hammer.
I got to say we're torn. We're torn on this
Let's pass.
Fry's Dog wants to know, and I actually don't know the answer. I'm reading this right now. I know the answer to this. Could a team shift their catcher to play in the field? Obviously, you would only do this with two strikes, and the guy would have to hit. But is it legal? I don't think it is. I don't think it actually is legal to put the catcher in the field. Do you know?
I don't know. Is there a rule about number of players who can be in fair territory? That would be, I guess. I would guess that's how they would define it.
I don't think that's true. I don't know. I think there has to be somebody behind the plate. I think there has to be somebody in foul territory.
I think you're probably right. I would also say, though, you wouldn't do it with two strikes, because if you do with two strikes, no matter where the pitcher's thrown, the guy would deliberately swing and miss and then just jog.
Oh, that's right. No, there'd be clearly the guy is struggling to come up with a scenario where you would actually do this. But I mean, I guess the question could be if it's legal. The other question is, I guess you could at some point, do you have to wear the catcher's gear behind the plate? Like, do you have to wear, I mean, I don't see why you wouldn't, but again, I mean, I don't know what the limitations of the catcher are. I guess I should look that up.
Yeah. I don't know that either. I'm going to guess that you have to field a catcher defensively.
Aaron wants to know, when should one put up Christmas decorations? When should one take them down?
Not obviously not before Thanksgiving. And right. I would say in general, not before December 1st. I would say December 1st is if you must get them up before December 1st for some reason, okay. But I would say December 1st is your target. Okay. And then I would say you have to take them down. Ideally, you take them down I would say January 4th.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's permissible to leave them up through New Year's, because New Year's still feels like part of the festive holiday season. But I think you can't go more than a week after New Year's with them up, or you're asking for trouble.
Next week, we're going to have Brandon McCarthy on.
Yes.
Very exciting. And we are going to ask him, because Brandon McCarthy is of the belief that you can start listening to Christmas music in August. That is his longstanding belief. He also, by the way, I sent him an email just sort of confirm everything that he was doing, and made like an LSU crack. You know, he's a big LSU fan. And I made like a little crack about LSU. And he said, I want to make this very clear. I am not coming on your podcast to be Seppenwald. I will not allow that to happen.
Thus guaranteeing that is going to happen. By the way, just to prep everybody, he has zero sense of humor about LSU. He has zero sense of humor about a Liverpool football. Zero sense of humor. I made in my phone for his contact profile picture. You know, you can assign a little picture to someone. I assigned him a picture of Luis Suarez biting someone. Suarez is like his favorite European football player of all time. And his profile pic, I changed. It used to be LSU, the LSU logo. And then I changed it to Suarez biting someone. And I sent it to him. And his response, I'm actually going to read his response, because this is how little of a sense of humor he has. Hold on one second. His actual response was, this is bad. This is bad podcasting. here we go. Hold on. He said, I can't wait until Melania arrests you for bullying.
Oh, wow. He doesn't have a huge sense of humor.
Not zero not sense kind of humor. Stuff. So, which means, thus guaranteeing, by the way, that we are going to talk about nothing but Luis Suarez biting people and LSU and Liverpool.
All right. One last question. John wants to know, who will win a championship first, the Padres or the Browns?
Wow.
Good question, John. Good question. John, neither is ever going to win a championship. So when you have zero chance of winning, one can't be first. However, I got to say that if the Stars would somehow, you know, I don't know, we have some sort of weird Avenger like destruction of the Earth or whatever. And they're the only two teams left. And one has to, at that point, win a championship. They're playing each other, I guess. Padres will be the first to win the championship. Don't you think?
No, I'm going the other way. I'm going Browns. Yeah, wow. I think it's harder to put together a championship MLB roster than it is a championship NFL roster, especially in this day and age where college quarterbacks are now coming in and starting as rookies and doing well. Like Cam Newton can come in and the Panthers can go from terrible
That's to true. That's
a Super
true.
Bowl team, a 15-1 Super Bowl team in like 2 years. I feel like if the Browns got lucky, and I feel like the right guys are running the Browns now. That's the first thing. And I think that if the Browns got lucky with their draft choices, if they picked Sam Darnold or whoever, and that person became a legit like star quarterback, if they got Deshaun Watson, for example, and like, you know, they have a couple studs on defense, and like if they got, you know, I think they could. I mean, I think any team in the NFL can get to win a Super Bowl in like 2 years. I think they can go from 0-16 to 11-5 and win a Super Bowl in 2 years. If a lot of things have to break their way, but I think it's possible in a way that I don't think the Padres are moribund, and they have some young prospects. You know, they got the guys in the Kimbrel trade from the Red Sox who seem like they're pretty good, and they have some good young guys. But I mean, name the, who's the best Padre? I mean, I think it's got to be Will Myers.
Will Myers is just the go-to. Myers is just the go-to.
I mean, and none of the people you would mention as the best Padres are pitchers, which is another big problem. So I feel like it's both of them have a far less than 1% chance of it happening anytime soon. But I think the Browns have a slightly higher chance of it happening.
It's not an unfair argument. I will say though that look at the Astros and the Royals the last few years. I mean The Royals were at least as moribund as the Padres, True. If not more so. And the Astros, it was a much shorter, moribund state. But, you know, I mean, they basically killed an entire network. I mean, it was death for those guys. True. So we'll see. It's neither is going to happen. So there's really Correct. Neither one of us can be wrong on that.
It's a moot point.
It is a moot point. All right, I think all of our listeners know that we have put to bed one last meaningless thing. Even though people don't want to accept it, Mike. I get emails and you know people want us to bring it back, but you know we've made a choice.
Sorry.
So we are trying out new things. Last podcast we tried out a random baseball, random athlete. We didn't have to be a baseball player. Random athlete that we would just mention for no apparent reason. This week we're going to go a little higher end. We are picking. We are each going to choose some small beam of light that is sort of gives us hope in today's world. Right? Is that
catchy?
Is that,
yeah.
I think I actually wanted to make the title even longer. You might remember that our last one was sort of like players we sort of just thought of or something at the last minute.
None of these are pithy. One last meaningless thing is pithy.
It's pithy.
But none of these are pithy so far. If we end up settling on any of these, we'll have to come up with a pithier name. But the idea here is some tiny little thing that makes us optimistic about the world. There's a lot of things that can make you pessimistic about the world. We're looking for one little tiny interesting thing that makes you optimistic. Yes. I think I started last time, so why don't you start?
Is that true? Is that true? That
I can't remember. It could have been.
Why don't you start? Why don't you start?
This is a courtesy of our producer TJ. I'm picking, and this is sort of in keeping with the last question. I'm picking the Philadelphia 76ers. The Philadelphia 76ers are kind of good. And by the way, as you might know, as I've talked about before, I'm super on the NBA train right now. I've belly flopped onto the Boston Celtics bandwagon and couldn't be happier about it. And in general, I'm watching a ton of NBA and I watch the 76ers play and they are really fun. They're winning games. They're winning right now as we speak they're beating the Wizards, a good team. They're 11-8 as we speak. Also, Joel Embiid is an insane basketball monster who's incredibly fun to watch. Ben Simmons is amazing. They were really smart. They picked up JJ Redick, who's like doing his bombing the threes from the kind of thing. And they're really, and they're like suddenly a viable team. Like they went, they've been so miserable for so long. And then, and it was always trust the process, trust the process, trust the process. And now if you trusted the process, you've been rewarded. That gives me a little bit of hope. If you're a 76er fan, that's awesome. And also I think that just, it reminds you of the days when I first became a sports fan in the 80s, like the 76ers were great. And it was wonderful to watch the Celtics and the 76ers and the Lakers. And I just think it's cool that like it actually worked, that who knows, long season, long way to go. They haven't won anything yet, but they are a viable team. They're a good team in the East. They have really exciting players. They seem to have drafted well. They still have a ton of draft picks going forward. So it is a happy little ray of light in the world of sports that the 76ers are once again viable and good.
Yes, I think that is 100% true. And actually, and they're not just good, they're fun.
Yeah.
They're
like yes. fun. They're good really in like a they're good watch. In a good way. It's like the Astros. They're good in a good way.
Exactly. Because you don't have to be. I mean, right? I mean, you can be like, "Oh, hey, they're winning, but they're like totally boring or not, you
just
know,
grinding just out like
grind." Yeah. Exactly. And they're not. They're like super fun to watch, and they're kind of the most fun. I mean, them and the Celtics at this point are the fun teams to watch in the East. I mean, the Cleveland has played a lot better and they still are Cleveland or whatever. But, while I'm watching the NBA, if the Sixers are the team or the Celtics are the team I want to watch right now, they're super fun.
No question.
So, all right, I just went onto a website just to sort of get a sense of what we're really trying to say here. And I literally cannot go onto a news website without getting some sort of piece of information that I did not know. That depresses the heck out of me. So I clicked onto this website, and apparently Garrison Keillor has been fired.
That's right.
Over alleged inappropriate behavior. Today was also the day Matt Lauer was fired over alleged inappropriate behavior.
Right.
It was also the day that a war criminal killed himself in the United Nations court.
He drank poison. This is the like in any other year, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened. And today, in 2017, it was like the 11th weirdest story. I mean, that really shows you what is happening in the world. A man charged of war crimes stood up, drank poison, announced that he had just drunk poison, was rushed to a hospital, and died.
That's what happened. Yeah.
That's it. That's what happened. That's the story.
And this is sort of the point of this whole thing. And so in that spirit, I took my daughter and wife to see a movie that's out now called Wonder, which is based on a children's book. And have you seen Wonder? You probably have not seen it yet.
I have not, although my son saw it and loved it.
Here's the thing about it, okay? It's not the best movie of the year by any stretch of the imagination. It's not a great movie or whatever. It's just about kindness. That's all it is. It's just this movie about this little boy who was, has I don't want to give away too much of the movie, but has a deformed face and body and has had to go through a million surgeries. And it's about his family and how they deal with it and his friends and how they deal with it. And it's just about human kindness. And I just went in there with no expectation. My daughter loved the book, so I was going to take her for sure. And we went in and sat down, and I'm like, this will be fine. It's like a kid's movie. It has Julia Roberts in it. And it'll be fine. And I came out of there so happy. I just came out of there. It's not a true story. It's not like but just watching people be kind to each other for like 2 hours and I don't know. I mean, it was like there used to be a lot of movies like that. I guess they're not as many as there used to be. It just made me feel so much better about things. And so it's just a movie. You might not have the same impact on you, but I just really, really walked out of there just feeling like, I had the same feeling in some ways when I went to see The Big Sick, which I've talked about on the broadcast. But The Big Sick is a brilliant movie. I mean, it's just the movie itself is wonderful. This is more of it's not made for TV movie-ish, but it's not significantly above that you know, that sort of, that's what it's going for. It's not going for,
sure.
But it's wonderful. It's just a wonderful little movie about people being kind to each other. Well acted, well, it was just a beautiful little movie. I'm so happy your son saw it. I mean, it's,
and then we went and bought the book because he wants to read the book now.
It's a wonderful book. That's why we went to see it in the first place. So anyway, that's my sort of sign of hope in.
So what are we? Oh, signs of hope. This is called signs of hope.
Yeah.
This is the segment it's called. All right. So we're going to have people vote, right? Or something on which one. So
that's right.
The first one is,
we pick random.
Hey, remember that guy?
Hey, remember that guy. That's what it is.
Hey, remember that guy. And the second one is signs of hope.
DJ, keep,
so we'll have to, please. Yeah, we'll keep the, and then next we got to figure out what the next one is so that we can tell Brandon. The next one should be funny things Luis Suarez can bite.
How about best LSU jokes?
That's good. Funny times LSU lost football games.
Fortunately, Brandon's not going to listen to this podcast because he claims he doesn't listen. Although he did know what Seppenwald meant. We had Alan Seppenwald on here. We just ripped him for being a Yankees fan. So he.
But to be fair, we told him that we were going to do
that.
How we invited Alan on. Was we said, come on the podcast so we can yell at you about the Yankees. And so we didn't sneak attack him.
Yeah. In fact, I think we were kinder to him than he expected. Which what does that say for us? But anyway, he won't listen to this because if he did listen to this, he wouldn't come on next week. We'd get that. I'm not coming on your stupid show thing. So
I'm gonna literally open the discussion with Luis Suarez. I'm gonna begin by saying, why does Luis Suarez always bite people?
Brandon, welcome to the show. So Luis Suarez,
let's get right to the point here.
As you know, we're here to discuss Luis Suarez and his biting people. It's gonna be so much fun. Well, Michael, as always, thank you.
Joe, thanks for having me.